The federal government has subsidized the biofuel industry with tax credits and price supports. The tax credit expired December 31st, and its renewal is pending before the new president and the new Congress. So we ask, should government subsidize plant-based fuels?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1086th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Drummondville who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Happy to be here.
Jason, now, quick question for you. Would you be willing to take a chunk of your paycheck and devote it to reducing the amount of greenhouse gases we are emitting and to reduce our dependence on foreign energy sources?
Yikes. That would definitely have to depend on how big of a chunk.
Uh-huh.
But I would think about it.
You would think about it. Well, let's think about it today, yeah, okay? Because that's what we're up to.
Let's do it.
Folks, it's been a while since oil hit $60 a barrel back there in 2005. When that did happen, the federal government established a renewable fuel standard to support plant-based alternative fuels. Government has since subsidized biofuels with tax credits and price supports. And when oil hit $147 a barrel, the renewable fuels industry boomed. But then came horizontal drilling and the Bakken and Permian basins and a glut of oil that sent prices plunging. The biofuel tax credits have now expired, and their renewal is pending before a new president and a new Congress. And that leads us to ask, should government subsidize plant-based fuels? Well, here to help us get the conversation going, we have Don Scott, who is the Director of Sustainability at the National Biodiesel Board. Don, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. Now, what part of the country are you hanging out today?
So the National Biodiesel Board is headquartered in the heartland in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
We're a nonprofit organization. We have members that produce biodiesel all across the country. From California to the East Coast.
And we always like to ask our guests who pays the way, so I would assume that it would be your membership, correct?
Yes, that's right. So our members that produce biodiesel fund the organization. We also get some support occasionally from USDA or the Department of Energy and a significant amount of funding from the feedstock organizations or the farmer organizations that grow things like soybean oil and canola oil that we make biodiesel out of.
Good to go. Now, you're the director of sustainability, and I've always admired the word sustainability because it could mean so many different things. I think 47 or 48 last time I checked. What exactly does a director of sustainability for the National Biodiesel Board do?
Well, I spend a lot of my time as an engineer quantifying the environmental benefits of biodiesel, whether those are the greenhouse gas reduction or the impact on water resources. And our membership, the board, has actually taken quite a bit of effort to carefully define what sustainability means to us. And so we define it as a balance of environmental impacts, social impacts, and economic impacts. And a key of what we want to achieve by achieving what we view as sustainability is preserving options for future generations so that they can make decisions for themselves and we're not limiting their decisions by consuming or destroying natural resources that they wouldn't have the option to use.
And biodiesel's been an option for a long time, has it not?
Yeah, my organization has been around since the early 1990s. It started as a research organization. Mm-hmm. The commercial industry really began putting biofuel in the market about 2004 and 2005.
But doesn't the history go back even precede, contemporary times? Doesn't it at least go back to World War II?
Well, going all the way back to the invention of the compression ignition engine by Rudolf Diesel. He fired the first diesel engine using peanut oil.
So we've been doing this for a long time.
Well, it's always been possible. but we've had cheap petroleum for 100 years, and so it wasn't really necessary until we started looking at how we can do things better for the environment and better for the economy in the last couple decades.
Mm-hmm. So we can run our engines on biodiesel fuel. What exactly does that mean? What does biodiesel mean for those of us who live in the city and don't yet run our cars on peanut oil?
Right. So biodiesel is a substitute for diesel fuel, and most of it that gets used is blended in with diesel fuel. All of the engine manufacturers in the U.S. that build heavy-duty trucks approve up to 20% biodiesel blended in with diesel fuel. And we make biodiesel out of fats and oils, so vegetable oils like soybean oil or cast-off animal fats from meatpacking and rendering facilities, and even used cooking oil.
Then the biodiesel industry is distinct then from the ethanol industry, which is the other biofuel, correct?
That's right. So ethanol industry is significantly bigger than biodiesel by volume. They've been at it a little bit longer than we have. They use sugars or starches to ferment that into alcohol that's used to blend in with gasoline.
So there's two different kinds of biofuel products presented to the general public. Alternatives to the hydrocarbons in oil and petroleum products, correct?
That's right. So you have a renewable option in the gasoline pool and also in the diesel pool. Mm-hmm. And we operate specifically in the diesel pool.
Well, one would have to say that petroleum products are renewable. It just takes a little time, right?
It takes a lot of time.
Maybe like 100 million years or something like that. Long, long time.
And like,
so here we're looking at a situation where we're trying to make fuels that are renewable. And there's a couple of reasons why we're really looking at this, right? One, of course, is to create alternatives to relying on hydrocarbons from elsewhere. And that was a situation in 2005 when the price of oil was going through the roof, correct?
That's right.
And that must have looked like pretty good times to you folks in the biofuels industry, 2005, when prices of oil were just boom.
Yeah, high oil prices made it much easier for a biodiesel plant to be profitable or economic. Also, a great need at the time because we were importing more petroleum than we ever had before in history. We were importing more than half of the petroleum we used. And we were sending something like $1 billion a day overseas for petroleum. We do a lot in our own communities. We spend our energy dollars in our own communities instead of spending that money overseas.
Think local first, right?
Right.
Well, okay, so we have the situation in 2005 where the price of energy is just simply going through the roof. And the federal government said, we got to do something about this. So they established a renewable fuels standard, which means what? What did that entail for us?
So the renewable fuel standard sets a minimum volume that we will use of specific categories of fuel. So there's a minimum volume of ethanol that's required and a minimum volume of biodiesel that's required. And then they also set some categories for advanced biofuels and things that we're hoping to develop in the future. And the intent was to grow that over time as the fuels became available.
So it's kind of a scalable thing. We start with a little bit and we build up to a lot as we grow and learn.
Yeah, and there was also an important recognition in there that fuel price volatility can harm us in both directions. High prices are bad. Low prices can also be a challenge.
Wait a minute. Hold the phone. Why would low prices be a challenge?
Well, specifically, if we're trying to develop our domestic industry, and this applies to renewable fuels. It also applies to domestic oil and gas and fracking and so forth. If the global price of petroleum is so low that our domestic supplies aren't profitable, well, they can essentially run us out of business. And if we don't have any domestic fuel to offer, and once we have closed the doors of all of our domestic energy suppliers, then OPEC can run the prices back up on us.
Which so pretty much, that pretty much defines the situation as we sit today, where OPEC has decided to restrict its output, thereby putting price on upward price on oil, thereby, you know, trying their best, I guess, to for a long time to put our domestic business out of business. Didn't quite work. And so that is the war, though, between the international energy industry and the domestic energy industry. And that's the subject we have on the table today. Why does it relate to agriculture? Because we're using foods, essentially, to turn them into fuel. And in that, we're going to reduce our emissions of greenhouse gases, and we're going to reduce our dependency on foreign oil. Question on the table today, should we subsidize plant-based fuels? I have with me today Don Scott, Director of Sustainability, National Biodiesel, and you. Pick up your phone and join us, 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080, right back.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Well, folks, there is a war going on for the money in our pocketbooks. It's them really against us. They are those who have great quantities of petroleum underneath the sands of their country. Middle East, we're thinking, but there's other, Russia, Venezuela, and they want us to pay maximum amount of money for their oil, which is quite natural. And then there are us. We don't want to pay all the maximum amount. We want to pay less. We want to have cheap oil. We want to have cheap energy. So one of the things we do, of course, is we have developed hydraulic fracking and horizontal drilling that has given us access to huge new sums of oil. We've also have been developing over the past decade or so the ability to turn plants or turn foods into fuel and thus power our engines. And that's a new kind of industry that is competing with the petroleum industry. So lots of competition now for ways to empower our economy. And the question we have on the table today, since the hydraulic fracking and horizontal drilling have made oil so cheap, should we continue to subsidize our biofuels industry? And if we don't, what does that mean down the line when we've used up all our oil? With us today, we have Don Scott with the National Biofuels Board. And we were hoping for David Bloom, but he didn't show up. So we'll continue. Maybe he'll call. So biofuels, how do you make biodiesel? We'll start with that.
So this is Don Scott with the National Biodiesel Board. We make biodiesel from fats and oils. The industry is becoming more diverse all the time. About half of the biodiesel made in the U.S. is made from soybean oil, with the other half made up of approximately equal portions of used cooking oil, animal fats, and some other inedible oils.
Why not corn oil?
We do use some corn oil that's a byproduct of ethanol production. And that's an inedible oil.
Okay.
That comes out as a byproduct of ethanol production.
So you take these fats, and how do you render them into biodiesel? What is the process there?
It's a pretty simple chemical reaction, actually. We take a ratio of oil to about 10% a ratio of alcohol in the presence of a catalyst, and it's a natural chemical reaction. And essentially, we're turning that thick, viscous vegetable oil into a substance that's that's more the consistency of diesel fuel so that we can use it in our existing diesel engine.
Good to go. Simple as that. What about ethanol?
So ethanol takes starches and sugars and ferments that into an alcohol that's blended in with gasoline.
Okay, so two different ways of providing our plant-based fuels. Now, back in 2005, like we were talking about earlier, price of oil was going through the roof. Went from $60 a barrel way up above $100 a barrel. And times were very good for those who were producing oil. And they were making lots and lots of money. And those of us who were driving our cars were going, oh, my God, this is hurting. And then the biofuels industry really took off then, did it? You had government subsidies to come up with ways of developing, you know, new fuels. How did that, what impact did that price escalation of petroleum have on the biofuels industry?
Well, it certainly helped with all the attention on high oil prices. It helped the nation realize that there is not a free market for petroleum, that OPEC is manipulating the price, and so that rather than let foreign interests determine what fuel we use, we should determine what fuel we use, and we should set up policies to promote domestic energy, both oil and gas, and our renewable industries.
To what extent did that help you, the industry, that boost of the oil prices? What were you folks able to do with that energy, as it were, in the marketplace, that encouragement to, you know, excel? What were you able to do with that?
So the biodiesel industry has grown steadily since 2004, where we were basically non-existent, to producing over 2 billion gallons a year. And so we're approaching 5% of diesel fuel being displaced by a renewable product that we make here that didn't exist before there were programs to support that.
So that's a significant increase, right? I mean, what was it before 2005?
Virtually zero. I mean, a few hundred thousand or maybe a few million gallons of biodiesel. Today we're over 2 billion gallons of biodiesel in the market.
Okay, so in huge difference. What about ethanol? Do you have a thumbnail on that as well?
So they started a little bit before us. They started in the 80s and 90s, and they're approaching 15 billion gallons in the market. So we essentially have 10% of our gasoline is being replaced with ethanol today.
Wow. So a significant, that is significant that we've made the leap to these biofuels, and these biofuels are now powering 10 to 5% of our energy needs. That's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's great to have this new renewable industry. You know, in 2015, the biodiesel industry supported 47,000 jobs, and we hope to continue to grow that as well.
What happened when they discovered horizontal drilling and fracking, and the Bakken and the Permian basins, and all of a sudden there was oil everywhere?
Yeah, well, the two things sort of started at the same time. In 2005, a lot of our energy policies both helped the fracking industry grow, helped domestic oil production, and helped renewable fuels grow at the same time. So both of them are benefiting from domestic policies that recognize we need to have our own energy supply.
And then when the oil prices collapsed, what happened to your industry? What happened to the oil industry?
Well, we're experiencing some pain in both. A lot of those oil fields in North Dakota are not producing today because they're not profitable now that OPEC has lowered the global price of oil. And the same thing is true for the biodiesel industry. It's much harder to be profitable. We've seen a lot of our biodiesel plants close their doors. We're proud that we're producing 2 billion gallons a year, but we have more than 3 billion gallons of installed production capacity. And if we could turn those plants back on, we could actually decrease the price per gallon that we're making biodiesel for.
How many plants closed? What percentage of them do you think?
It's in the hundreds. How many biodiesel plants are existing across the country? 200 to 300, and we probably have half of them that are operating.
Wow.
Today.
So that was a significant hit to the industry then. As well as the petroleum industry. So there was a lot of pain when the price collapsed then.
Yeah, it's very challenging. And the policies that supported the biodiesel, the industry responded to that. The industry said, okay, well, the government wants us to develop this renewable resource. We will do that. We will build biodiesel plants. And now that tax credit has expired. And so all of those companies are hanging in limbo.
Mm-hmm. So for a long time, we had a significant support from the federal government, both in terms of money, but also in terms of encouragement, as it were, telling the general public, you know, we have to come up with a new way of doing things. We have to look for new sources of fuel, and that's where we need to go. And now we have a new president coming to town who kind of is saying two things, as far as I can understand. One thing he is saying is that we're going to continue supporting the biofuels industry. And the other thing he is saying is that we need to bring in as many different sources of energy as possible. And if we do that, won't that in effect amplify the situation where we have so much energy that the price goes down again? Am I seeing that wrong?
You're absolutely right that President-elect Trump campaigned on his support for biofuels and biodiesel and the renewable fuel standard.
Mm-hmm.
So he has indicated to continue that support. And I think we all agree with the notion that we need as many energy options as possible. And I think there's also some evidence to show that renewable options are going to continue to get cheaper. We can see that in the biodiesel industry.
What happens when it does? Folks, the question of the day, should we subsidize plant-based fuels? 831-479-1080. Michael Olson with Don Scott, Director of Sustainability, National Biodiesel Board. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Tip Program. Today we're talking about the possibility of turning our food into fuel and doing it with the help of taxpayer subsidies. Federal government has been subsidizing the biofuel industries with both tax credits and crops price supports. And, of course, when we say that federal government has been doing that, that means you and I have been doing that with our taxes. So the question we have on the table today is, should we continue that subsidizing, or should we allow the biofuel industries to go out on their own and try to survive in the world? And with respect to that, we're talking with Don Scott, who is the Director of Sustainability with the National Biofuels Board, Biodiesel Board. And a question, Don, with respect to petroleum, is there anything more efficient at delivering energy than oil?
Actually, oil is how nature stores energy, and that's true for petroleum, and it's definitely true for the vegetable oils and fat that we turn into biodiesel. Specifically to those, that's how nature stores solar energy. And I think we should recognize that we need to be using more solar energy. We're seeing a proliferance of windmills and solar panels, which are great at capturing solar energy, but they're not good at storing solar energy. We actually have this natural process already in place where plants store solar energy in fats and oils. And it makes a lot of sense to turn those into diesel fuel so we can displace fossil fuels.
Now, with respect to the energy stored in plant oils, how does that compare with the energy stored in petroleum oils?
If you're comparing biodiesel with diesel fuel, you know, your power, your torque, your horsepower, mm-hmm. your miles per gallon is relatively the same. The benefit comes in is that the majority of that energy in biodiesel comes directly from the sun, where all of that energy stored in petroleum was stored in the Earth's crust for hundreds of millions of years and can't be reproduced on a human scale.
But it did come from the sun as well.
A long time ago.
Okay, fair enough.
Hundreds of years.
Well, let's talk about the ways in which government, or you and I, have been subsidizing the alternative or renewable fuel industry. One way, of course, is via tax credits. The other way is through price supports. And I guess the biofuel industry has been benefiting through both subsidies, correct?
We have. We've had a biodiesel blender's credit since 2005. That has expired. Our industry is campaigning vigorously to get that renewed. It has expired several times in the past, and it's always been renewed in the past. We want to get that tax credit renewed because we want to produce 2.5 billion gallons of biodiesel next year. We want to create 81,000 domestic jobs, which will pay $3.2 billion in wages and have a total economic benefit of almost $15 billion.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal. But how exactly does a tax credit work?
So it is in the past, it's been set up that you get a tax credit when you blend biodiesel into diesel fuel. We're actually trying to change that so it's you get the tax credit at the producer level, and that way the tax credit will have more benefit directly to our domestic production.
Now, and of course, we're going to shift quickly to the crop price supports. How do they work?
They're independent of biodiesel. We've had lots of programs to help agriculture throughout the decades, just as we have for petroleum. We've had petroleum subsidies for over 100 years, and we put those all in place for good reasons. We wanted domestic industry, going all the way back to 1916. We wanted a domestic oil industry, so we subsidized it. And the same thing is true for agriculture. We want a steady, abundant food supply. We want to eliminate price volatility, but we absolutely want to avoid shortages. We want to make sure that if the market ever fails, it fails on the side that we have more food than we can possibly eat. And so that's the logic behind a lot of those crop subsidies. And it's worked. Mm-hmm. And that has led to the development of the biofuels industries, because as we grow food to feed the world, specifically as we grow protein to feed the world, the plants that we get our food from naturally produce more fats and carbohydrates than we can possibly eat. And it's those excess fats that we're using for biodiesel.
And going back quickly to the tax credits, something happened with respect to those credits where it made it possible for people in other countries to decide to participate in that program, thus diminishing the ability of domestic producers to compete. Somehow that worked, right?
Yeah, so it's always been a blender's credit in the past.
Which, what is it? A blender's credit means whoever's blending the biodiesel fuel with the diesel, with regular diesel, gets the credit. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
And the World Trade Organization regulations would prohibit you from saying, we're only going to give you the credit if you produce or if you blend fuel that's produced in a certain country. So that would be unallowable. And this.
So in other words, what we were doing, we're paying tax credits to other countries to provide us with biodiesel so that we would become less dependent on other countries. Oh, this is getting confusing.
It is. Well, for the majority of the time since 2005, the tax credit has benefited almost solely domestic production. But what's also happened in recent years, especially in 2015 and 2016, is that South America has really ramped up their production as well. So they were able to take advantage of this blender credit just in the last 2 years. It's been a relatively recent phenomenon, but it has been significant.
Okay, so, well, we're going to go to the phones, folks. Well, the number today is 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080. The essential question we would like to come to grips with is, should we subsidize plant-based fuels, or can the industry somehow make it on its own? And I'm sure we'll have other discussions as well, and we'll start them off right now with Liberty. Liberty, welcome to the Food Chain Radio program.
Yes, good morning. I tuned in a little late, but it's a subject dear to my heart. I wanted to plug commercial hemp as a source of oil, because it was my understanding that the first diesel was run on hemp oil, not peanut oil. And the hemp seed is about 30% oil, and depending on how the hemp plant is grown, it can be grown for either fiber or seed. And
Liberty, let me ask you a question. Do you think the federal government should subsidize the production of hemp seeds for biodiesel?
No, I don't think they should subsidize anything. I think the free market ought to reign. If they had just legalized it and let farmers grow it, it wouldn't have to be subsidized.
Well, let's ask Don. Don, what are the best sources of biodiesel, and does the hemp seed figure into that? Thank you for the call, Liberty.
Well, if you could grow hemp commercially for the fiber, we could definitely use the excess oil for biodiesel. We can make biodiesel out of any vegetable oil, and that's essentially what we do. We use all of the leftover oils that can't find a use anywhere else.
So it's possible to make best use of it that way as well. Well, okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to go to Sam, who has an interesting question about developing the possibility of a hybrid fuel system. Question on the table today, should we subsidize the production of biofuels? And if we don't, what happens later down the line, 25 years from now, when all that wonderful fracking oil and made possible by fracking and horizontal drilling runs out? And where are we then? So that's the question on the table today. What do you think? 831-479-1080. Should we take money out of our paycheck for biofuels? We will be right back. 831-479-1080.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
If your family car runs out of gas or oil or water, its engine will fail. If your body runs out of essential mineral or vitamin or amino acid nutrients, it will grow weak and you will be left with aches, pains, and diseases. Some say you can get all 90 of the essential nutrients you need from foods you eat. Maybe, but if you eat foods from farmed-out soils or foods that have had the life processed out of them, you will deprive your body of some essential nutrients. You can get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than a daily latte with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack. It's easy, it's delicious, and they are essential.
Get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs to grow strong and stay healthy with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack at NutriensToGo.com. That's NutriensToGo.com. Get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than the cost of a daily latte at NutriensToGo.com. That's NutriensToGo.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
Well, folks, you and I have invested a significant amount of our paychecks on developing alternative fuels, to alternatives to those hydrocarbon products that come from the Middle East, from Russia, from Venezuela. And we now have 10% of our gasoline being made up of ethanol from our corn crops and our soybean crops. We now have 5% of our diesel being produced from our crops. An amazing feat for you and I, right? And we did it by encouraging the biofuels industries with the money from our paycheck? Should we continue that support, given the fact that hydraulic fracking and horizontal drilling have made huge new sums of oil possible? They're big, giant reservoirs of oil out there now for us to take advantage of. So should we keep the money in our pocket, or should we continue to spend it? That's the question we have on the table. Our guest today, Don Scott, Director of Sustainability, National Biodiesel Board, and you. Right now, we're going to check in with Sam, I believe, who has a question about possibility of hybrid systems. Sam, welcome aboard.
Hi, Michael. Good morning. Yes, I was listening since you guys started. I was thinking about sensors, but first of all, yes, I would vote for the biodiesel subsidizing.
Good.
Yes, I would vote for that. I would be willing to give $100 a year because of my income to the better good of the earth and to the people. But also I want to talk about natural gas, because we have abundance of natural gas. I was wondering, maybe some engineer or somebody could make a vehicle or some kind of fuel tank that would be like, you could put diesel and biodiesel in one. You could put your gasoline, the ethanol gas in one. And then you could put natural gas in the other, all in one vehicle. And have a switch where you can switch it off from different, energy tanks. And then the consumer can make his choice on which, who he wants to, put his money.
That's a very interesting question. Let's ask Don Scott, who is a diesel engineer, so probably knows quite a bit about alternative fuel switch possibilities. And what do you think, Don? Possibility of switching back and forth like that?
From an engineering standpoint, all things are possible. You know, the military built multi-fuel vehicles back in the Vietnam era, where they used diesel or gasoline. And there are scientists at DOE working on right now engines that would switch back and forth between diesel and gasoline, or gaseous fuels like natural gas, to try and make them more powerful, more energy efficient, and more clean burning. Today, diesel fuel and biodiesel is the best option we have for the existing fleet, both for fuel economy and for reducing emissions, including greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay, well, Sam's going to give you $100 a year. How are you going to spend it? What are you going to do?
I'm going to invest that in biodiesel, and I'm going to give him back $150 at the end of the year.
Oh, that's a pretty good deal for which I'm sure Sam will be most grateful. And also we have, let's see, by golly, David, are you there?
I'm here, Michael.
Good, good. We have David Bloom, who is the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and with whom I've been working on this subject for quite a while. David, we started way back with cellulosic ethanol. Where are we with cellulosic ethanol these days?
Well, you know, Michael, I've been going to alcohol conferences for 35 years, and cellulosic ethanol is always 5 years away.
There it is, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a boondoggle. What it is, it's an intentional distraction. It's like really good solutions like biodiesel or alcohol are here today. And so, gosh, if you were an oil company, maybe you'd create an argument like food versus fuel and say, oh, we got to use plant fiber because we don't eat it. And so we got to make that into alcohol, even though it's the very hardest darn whatever way to do it. And, it just distracts everything for 10 or 15 years while people try to figure it out. So, those oil guys are pretty clever.
So we're always looking for that magic enzyme that will do the impossible, in other words.
Well, yes, people would like to have an enzyme that does that because they can patent it and own it and then, charge a lot for it. And it's not cheap anymore to make alcohol. But, I don't want to ride roughshod into alcohol because this is really kind of a show about biodiesel. So
No, this is a show about whether we taxpayers should continue subsidizing our efforts to develop biofuels.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, right now, there's several economists, arm's length, third-party economists, that have studied this issue because it comes up all the time. And it says for every dollar that we use to subsidize alcohol, and I would assume this also applies to biodiesel, you return $6 in tax to the government. So why is that? Well, you know, basically when you pay a farmer to grow soybeans and make biodiesel or grow another crop and make alcohol, that farmer takes that money that he's gotten for that crop and spends it here. If you give money to Chevron to make oil, that money is sent to the transnational offices where it doesn't do any good here. And oil companies have had an amazing array of tax credits to make sure they don't pay anything. So we pay our fair share in biofuels, and it goes back into the economy. Now, how do you know that?
Well, hold on, David. We got to take a quick break. But when we come back, we have a few minutes left. And the big question I want to ask both of you is, can the biofuels industry stand on its own, or does it need the support of we, the taxpayer? This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, we will be right back after these very important messages. So don't go away. Well, what do you think out there? Have we, the taxpayers of the United States of America, been getting a good deal by giving up a chunk of our paychecks every year to the biofuels industry to develop an alternative for us, and an alternative that will give us a way out from underneath the thumb of OPEC and those people who have oil, so that we have our own sources of oil that help us reduce our emissions of greenhouse gases? Have we been getting a good deal, and should we continue to spend that money? Here's Steve, who has a question that really kind of relates and sums it up really well. Steve, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hey, how you doing?
Very good.
Good. Hey, my question is, and I've seen this a bunch of times, is, and maybe I don't want to make a factual statement because I'm not an expert, but from what I know about using alcohol fuels, there are several big downsides. Not only does it take a lot to produce them, but also they only provide about half the BTUs that regular fossil fuels provide. But the other part, which I think is more important, which is completely overlooked, is there is no lubricity in the fuel, and the maintenance costs go up dramatically. You see that a lot in drag racing vehicles where they use alcohol to increase horsepower, but at the cost of double the fuel consumption and also the frequent teardowns mechanically because the parts are just turned to garbage, especially the cylinders and rings.
Okay, Steve, we're really short on time, so I'm going to pitch that to David Bloom.
Yeah. That's my thing. I just wonder if you could comment on it.
Thank you very much, David. You're the man on alcohol.
Parade of propaganda from oil companies, and not a single thing that you've just questioned is true. So we have to take a show to explain why on each one of those. But alcohol triples engine life. It reduces emissions by 90%+. It does not cause corrosion. In fact, it keeps the carbon off the inside of the engine completely. And I'm going to leave room for one more question, I guess. But basically,
here's the question, and then I'd like to have both of you address: can the biofuels industry thrive and survive without taxpayer money, or does it need taxpayer money to survive? Let's start with Don Scott from the National Biodiesel Board. Don?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. There is no free market for petroleum. OPEC has been using oil price as a weapon since 1974, and we have lots of subsidies for domestic oil production embedded in our tax code for over 100 years. So there is no free market. We can't just leave it up to the free market. We have to decide what's best for us. We have to decide what creates the most jobs, what does the best for the environment. And I think we need to have more discussions like this so that the biofuels industry can speak up and share. It's like, here's what we're willing to give back. If you give us a $2 billion tax credit,
we're going to give you 80,000 jobs. We're going to give you $3 billion in wages and almost $15 billion in economic impact, so that we're not actually costing you money, but if you give us a level playing field for our industry, we're going to make more money for everybody in America.
David?
Well, there isn't a level playing field, and oil has a lot of benefits. But rather than dwell on that, I should point out that our own wonderful Dianne Feinstein, as well as Oklahoma Senator, I'll leave his name out for the moment, deleted all the subsidies for alcohol fuel made from corn in the United States.
Okay, David, we're out of time, but I want to thank both of you, David Bloom, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and Don Scott, Director of Sustainability National Biodiesel Board. Remember, folks, Michael Olson's first law of the food chain, agriculture, the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.